have never done this before, but we thought it'd be fun to record this one. We thought it'd be fun to record our next episode because Carmen is home. And we thought it'd be fun to, like, stream it live.
Woo!
Yeah, so we're going to be...
Also, Manny enticed me with tacos, so I'm at his house.
I did no such thing.
We recorded this episode, like, last year?
No, it was, like, January.
No, it was, like, early this year.
It was January. So, basically, last year.
This was the one where my throat... I was, like, running out of voice, essentially. Right,
yeah. So we're recording, if you're hearing this on our podcast as usual, just FYI, we recorded this live on our Instagram, which you should follow. This is our shameless plug at San Jose Podcast. We have never done this before, but Carmen is home for the holidays, and I thought it'd be fun to live record this and stream it at the same time.
Again, and Manny bribed me with dinner, so of course I came over. Thanks for the invite.
So, what are we talking about today, Carmen?
All right. Well, if you didn't already guess it from our background behind us, it's the Rangsdorf house, which I don't know if it's Rangsdorf. Do you think it's Rangsdorf or do you think it's like Reng?
I mean, the guy we're going to be talking about today was German, so I'm going to say it was like Rangsdorf.
Okay, well, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to go with Rangsdorf.
Right.
So we are covering the Rangsdorf house, a.k.a. the R house, which our house in the middle of the street is located at 3070 North Shoreline Boulevard, Mountain View, California.
So, fun fact, this is actually considered to be the oldest standing house in Mountain View. It has 12 rooms, 3,955 square feet, and it dates back to 1867, although I have a weird, like, conflict later that I found. The house was fully restored in 1991, and then today it still functions as a museum, but according to their website, and this is really weird, so I told you, we recorded this episode originally in January 2022, and we both were... just like, no, we didn't. That was the first time we've ever scrapped an episode completely because we just did not like how we recorded it. So it was restored and it said that they've been closed since January, but they didn't say what year due to COVID. And that's been up there since this past January. So who knows? But it still says that. So I don't know. And according to mountainview.gov, quote, the Rangsdorf House stands proudly today as one of the finest examples of Victorian Italian architecture on the West Coast, as well as a resource for the community to enjoy. And the house houses, see what I did there, several artifacts from its heyday, such as an Edison machine and a working phonograph. Phonograph? Phonograph.
Phonograph?
I think it's phonograph. And a magnetobox telephone, which we had to look up because I didn't know what that was. The house has been relocated actually two times, and it boasts the designation of being on the National Register of Historic Places, with its reference number being 7800778.
Well, next up, we have some more history about the house that'll be given to you by Manny.
So, as I mentioned, it was built in 1867. It's a two-story Italian mansion. It was built by Henry Rangsdorf. So, Henry Rangsdorf was a 49er, not the football team, but, like, you know, 1849er, immigrant from Germany. He was actually a little late to the party when the gold rush happened, and he ended up working on a boat that shipped things across the San Francisco Bay for a while before moving to San Jose for a farming job. Then later in 1853, he took advantage... Get this, Carmen. Imagine if you could do this today. He took advantage of how California law worked at that time, and he managed to get himself 290 acres of land in San Jose. He just pretty much just claimed it.
What?
Yeah.
Right.
Can imagine I just walk out. I'm like, hi, this is mine now. Thanks. Bye. That was it.
As did the colonizers.
Hence... 3 years later, he doubled that plot of land. And
what?
Yeah. Dude, no. By the time he died, he had acquired over 10,000 acres of land across the bay. So yeah, this guy was loaded.
I'm just gonna go to Antarctica.
Stake your claim.
This is my iceberg.
Yeah, so he married Christine Hassler in 1864 and had 7 children. Henry died in 1907, and his home was later inherited by his orphaned grandson, Perry, who sold it in 1959 to a development company. In the 60s, it was rented to Max and Mayetta Crump. And this is where the spooky stuff happens. Like, a lot of the documented spooky stuff starts to happen because they experienced a lot of loud noises. They heard crying children, heavy footsteps. And they even had a former police German Shepherd, and he would hide under the bed when he would hear these noises.
And that, is that why it was a former police German Shepherd?
Dang, I don't know.
Or he's just retired. He's like, you know what? That's not on my job description anymore.
Not my job.
Not my job.
I don't know, but that to me, that's like confirmed haunted right there. The house sat empty and in disrepair for a bunch of years after that, and it was actually going to be demolished in 1980 until the local communities saved it, moved it, and restored it. It was reopened to the public in 1991, and Carmen, do you want to go through our list of all the rooms this thing has?
Oh my gosh. So this is all that I want out of my future home. So as we said earlier, the house has 12 rooms. The first floor makes up of a formal parlor, a family parlor, music room, library, a dining room, and kitchen. The second floor is made up of 4 different bedrooms, a sewing room, a servant's quarters, and they're all currently used as offices.
Wild. Again, the house is 3,955 square feet. It has 10-foot ceilings on the second story and 11-foot ceilings on the first. It's got 4 marble fireplaces, including 1 black marble fireplace in the library. I didn't even know that was like a thing, but that sounds very elegant. They have solid mahogany newel posts and handrails on the staircase and hand-turned balusters. As I mentioned before, most sources I found say that the house was built in 1867, but I have right here Haunted Houses of California by Antoinette May, and this book says 1887, so like what is the truth? I don't know.
Let's go with the older one.
Sure, yeah, I agree. Also, it says that he had 6 children, not 7. I don't know. And also, it mentioned that he came to this country with only $4, but he died in this house, a very rich man. After Rangsdorf died, I mentioned, you know, his orphaned grandson inherited the house. And again, his name is Perry Ascom. He came to live at this house, and he actually grew up to be a Broadway star.
Which I'll go ahead and go into later.
Yeah. After some time in the show business, he returned to the Rangsdorf house in 1945 until he died in 1961. Where it was then acquired by the Newhall Development Company, and then there were some disputes after that. It got a little wild. Mostly, the local community just didn't know if they should renovate, demolish, or just relocate the house. And local officials and historians got into actually pretty fierce debate about this house. So it got heated, and the city of Mountain View later bought it for just $1 in 1979. $1.
That's not even that long ago.
And again, they finished restoring it in March of 1991. It's now a museum, and you can also rent it out for weddings and stuff. Carmen, do you want to give us a little bit about the legend?
All right. So, according to Antoinette May's book cited earlier by Manny, in the early 1960s, there was only 2 people that worked for Newhall Land and Farming Company, Max and Mayetta Crump. While living there, they would often be awakened by the sound of a crying child and sometimes thumping on the stairs. Years later, Crump admitted to the Times Tribune that, "Finally, I just came to believe that there was something in the house that I couldn't understand." Rather humble.
Spooky.
So there's actually more to their story. When they first moved in, they found a set of restraining cuffs among the furnishings, but they never figured out what they were used for. So,
yikes.
pretty scary.
I know.
And, like, what if somebody came into the house and just did that while they were, like, you know, renovating or anything like that?
I don't know, but that's... yikes. Yeah, so, like a bunch of places we've talked to before, the famous Sylvia Brown visited the home and actually did a séance here. Apparently, she was immediately confronted by the apparition of a hawk-faced man being pushed in a wheelchair. What does that mean, Carmen? Hawk-faced? Is that a term? That people use?
Oh, wouldn't think so. I just think of, like, somebody with a hawk face. Maybe he had a big nose.
I don't know.
Which is kind of mean.
That's just what it said in our sources, but...
What if they had a beak?
Or that.
And beady eyes.
Very patriotic. Oh, wait, no, that's eagle. Wait, strike that. Also, apparently he was missing a leg due to a farming incident. I don't really know how she got that detail, but, and then...
My leg!
Yeah, and apparently also the other one was affected by arthritis. She also saw a psychic image of a man being strangled in the upstairs bedroom.
See, this is what I'm talking about. Maybe that's what the restraining cuffs were for.
I don't know.
All right. So, next up, according to Ghost Hunter's Guide to the SF Bay Area by Jeff Dwyer, the ghosts of either Christine Rangsdorf or her daughter Christine haunts the second floor of the 1867 mansion. So, visitors have often claimed to see a slim figure of a woman with long dark hair, although they cannot specify whether she appears to be middle-aged or teenaged. Hmm. Visitors and staff members have heard disembodied crying and thumping on the walls, footsteps, and breathing. Super creepy. Ghost hunters have captured EAPs here, including some German words.
This place is just full of, like sounds. I feel like most of what we're getting is just, like, random sounds. But, like, random German words. Can you imagine? Like, you're getting up in the morning and just, nein.
No.
Nein.
Just yelling.
Ich liebe Deutschland. I don't know. The house was also investigated in 2004 by professional investigator Gloria Young. I think it's the first time we've ever talked about her, but she actually has quite the repertoire. She actually began investigating paranormal activity in the early 90s, and she's performed hundreds of investigations ever since. During her investigation here, she provoked spirits and was met with flickering lights and collected evidence with a voice recorder and cameras. She concluded by saying, "I would definitely say there is something here in the parlor and front hall."
So that's like the entire house at this point now.
Yeah.
All right, so I can now deduce why it also might be haunted. So according to an article called Rangsdorf Mansion Eerie House, I couldn't find the author's name. Just kidding. The name is Gautam. The mansion itself was built on the burial ground or grave site of early pioneers and settlers. Then, according to part one of the YouTube series Saving Rangsdorf House, produced by Jennifer Fay, the land was then used by Henry Rangsdorf as a feeding area for pigs. So that might not have gone over that well with the spirits and people who were buried there.
That's interesting, because I know that we mentioned that the house was relocated, I think, twice. So, like...
Mm.
Was it, I don't know, that could be the original, or, like, the, I don't know, that, I'm just wondering if, like, it's been moved since, or, I don't know.
So, actually, within the same article are stories from a different article, Articleception. The following stories were taken from You Are Now Entering Mountain View, a collection of short writings about Mountain View done by students of Old Mountain View High in 1976. The Rangsdorf Mansion chapter was written by Anne Tamaru and Pat Catalico, who interviewed the Crump family, the last residents of the mansion. The Crumps said that they often heard the sound of non-existent baby crying at night and the sounds of something walking up and down the house's narrow staircase. During the night, the Crumps would be awakened by the sound of a child crying, but investigators could never find the source. When the Crumps were out, Their friends once dropped by, and when they knocked on the empty house's door, its doorknob turned by itself. An old Mexican man used to walk by the house as a shortcut to get to the nearby dumps. When the Crumps moved into the house, he asked for permission to walk through the property. He also told Mr. Crump of the story of a young woman with long dark hair that he would often see staring out of the house's large bay windows, which is also very creepy. So in these comments, the author Guatam responded to a previous comment. Thanks, Justin. It was a real short visit, but given that I was there at so early in the morning, I was a little reluctant to enter the house, although I did see a caretaker. Or was it a ghost?
According to hauntedhouses.com, there are also apparitions of a young lady, a heartbroken young lady, and generally just thumping in cold spots throughout the house. Additionally, a November 3rd, 2011 article in the Mercury News titled Mountain View's Ranksurf House Blends History and Horror in Belated Halloween Event quotes Jimmy Kaminsky, who was president of the Friends of the Ranksurf House group, who said that, quote, threatening voices, moving furniture, and a supernatural-like presence have all been reported over the years. Also, quick shout-out to the group Friends of the Ranksurf House for all their work in preserving it and its history, and you can check out their website at friendsoftherhouse.org, where they also post some events, or you can find them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Next up, Carmen, hit us with the personal accounts.
So overall, the Ranksurf House was rated at a 4.5 stars out of 5 on both Yelp and Google reviews, which is kind of the first. It now doubles as a wedding slash event venue slash museum. So tours are docent led, usually by someone who is wearing an era accurate style dress, which makes me think of that one Parks and Rec episode with Patton Oswalt. I don't know if you remember.
Where he like is churning the butter. Yeah.
So, the worst review was a 3-star review by Rai T from San Francisco, California, posted in 2019. And they wrote, "We came here for a wedding. It's an old house built by Mr. Ranksurf and converted to a site for designated weddings and small events. It was an outdoor wedding. The wedding itself was great, but it was an evening wedding, and as the evening wore on, it got colder and more windy. A couple of young ladies wore mini dresses, and I don't know how they could tolerate the night chill. Hubby had to get an emergency thin fleece blanket from the car for me to use, but it was still not warm enough. I needed my down jacket. There's a side yard for the ceremony and a front yard. It's pretty grassy and thin. High heel shoes are not good to wear here. The buffet dinner was held in the backyard. There were a few tower heaters, but not enough. A lot of the guests would circle around the heaters to stay warm. I think we could have used 6 more heaters. If you're considering a wedding here, make sure it's in the heat of summer when the evening temps are still hot. I feel like I was about to go skiing, given how cold it was. There's only 2 bathrooms in the house, which are not unisex. The women's bathroom only has 2 stalls."
There's so many unnecessary details in this.
I know. Like,
okay.
And it didn't flow. Well, guess what, Righty? It wasn't your wedding, so stop being such a diva. At me. I dare you. Carmen Sanchez, 428. Anyway, so the worst review on Google Reviews is written by Luna Moon, a local guide who wrote, "This is right by Shoreline Park and is a great place to walk around."
That's the worst review.
That's the worst review. I don't know. Like, why would they give them a, what, like a 3 or like a 1? I just don't understand.
It's a great place to walk around, but...
Also, we have a celebrity comment who was written by Snoop_Dogg, who wrote, "It was a very Ranksurfy experience," which I feel like if Snoop Dogg actually visited, it's pretty much what he would say. So I had to add that.
All right, Carmen, hit us with the pop culture, because there's a good amount here.
okay. So basically, I took to YouTube originally, and there's actually a series or a YouTube series called Saving Rengsdorf House. It's a 3-part series that basically uncovers the history of the land, Henry Rengsdorf, his journey purchasing the land, as well as the restoration of the R House by the Friends of R House group, which Manny shouted out earlier. The series is produced by Jennifer Fay from the Bay Area News Group 2011. Also, I know I said it was a 3-part series, but apparently the last video was never released through a source in the YouTube comments, Yuritsa Rodriguez, who commented a little over 11 months ago since I read this, that there would be an update in the year to come. So still not this year. I went to Wikipedia for information on Perry Ascom, as we stated earlier, who is a renowned Broadway star. Perry Ascom was born August 31st, 1898 in Seattle, Washington, and died October 22nd, 1961 in San Francisco, California. Perry was an American actor and baritone singer, best known for his roles in the theater and opera. He starred in his most prominent role, Sweet Kitty Bel-Air's, in 1930, The Crusades in 1935, and Gypsy Nights, short film released in 1935. His grandfather was Henry Rengsdorf, and he went to Santa Clara University to study music. Interesting. Next up, we have the Chowchilla kidnappers claimed that they were inspired to carry out the kidnapping by the 1971 movie Dirty Harry. Sorry,
I know this seems like it has it was a total random point. I promise you it has to do with it, but we'll get to it in the related facts. I just want to point that out, that it's random.
Okay, so as for the pop culture bit, I'll go ahead and discuss the movie Dirty Harry. So, it's actually a series of neo-noir action thriller films from 1971 to 1988. But I'm going to thoroughly discuss the first Dirty Harry movie, which is called Dirty Harry, released in 1971, directed by Don Siegel. So, this film, the original Dirty Harry film, stars Clint Eastwood, who was the former mayor of Carmel, as you should know from the episode 39, The Tour House. Turns out this pop culture fact is going to be more of a crimeception tangent because, one, the plot is actually based off the Zodiac Killer, and two, subsequently following this film, it has inspired a horrifying amount of real-life copycat crimes and killers. So,
what?
So first off, the plot, and if you think this is a spoiler alert, please skip to like 15 seconds or so, because this movie came out in 1971, so GTFO. So the plot consists of a psychopathic sniper that shoots a woman and threatens to shoot more people if he's not paid off $100K. The film, also funnily enough, is based in Crime Central San Francisco. So if you actually watch the film, there's a bunch of different locations, such as Dolores Park and different locations from the time that took place or were filmed in those areas, just shot around San Francisco. So why is Harry so dirty in the first place? I was unamused to keep researching this particular aspect, but I think it's just because he doesn't play by the rules, as most neo-noir thriller action films. Second up, here are the real-life crimes that have taken place due to the imbeciles that idolize this movie. And as I asked earlier to Manny, how many ransom plot movies does it take to inflict this much harm?
I mean, there's a trio of them, so apparently three.
Okay, well, it only takes one movie to have three follow-up crimes. So anyway, I'll go ahead and discuss those currently. So we have one, the Faraday School shooting, which actually took place in Victoria, Australia. So this film, once it was made international, basically more people across the world were like, hey, that sounds like a good idea. So anyway, two armed men kidnapped a teacher and six school children and demanded $1 million, which is upping the price from the film, by the way, $1 million ransom, in which the government agreed to pay. But spoiler alert, the children somehow managed to escape, and the kidnappers were then jailed. Womp womp. So, following that in 1976, the Chowchilla kidnapping, where I'll actually leave this for Manny later to unfold what happens and how it was connected to the Rangsdorf house. But lastly, September, which is important in a second, 1981 in Germany, a young 10-year-old girl named Ursula Herrmann was buried alive in a box with ventilation, lighting, and sanitary system, which at first you would think, all right, sounds okay. She was held for a ransom. The girl actually ended up suffocating 48 hours later after her abduction due to the ventilation system getting clogged by autumn leaves, which is why the September aspect is kind of important. So, the next time you listen to Autumn Leaves by Ed Sheeran, please think about poor Ursula.
Oh my gosh.
But anyway, luckily, 27 years later, a couple was actually arrested and tried for the kidnapping and murder on circumstantial evidence. So this case was also brought to light on the German equivalent of Unsolved Mysteries, a TV series called, and I'll go ahead and give Manny the mic to try and pronounce this.
Okay, I don't speak any German, but I can if you'd like. That's a Lady Gaga reference.
Okay. Oh, so I'm so uncultured. I'm sorry.
It's the TV series Aktenzeichen XY Ungelöst.
Do you have any idea what that might be? Aktenzeichen XY?
No idea. No idea. I know what X and Y are.
All right, well, now it's time for Manny's turn for the related facts.
Woo! Okay, this is going to be a wild ride. We'll start with the easy one. And this is just like an aside. Henry Rangsdorf helped found the Wiseman School. He later served as a school district trustee, and then he and his wife were trustees of the Presbyterian Church. The Wiseman School would later become the modern Mountain View Wiseman School District. And also there's a Rangsdorf Center and a Rangsdorf Park in Mountain View. Just little fun facts. But here, now we get to the wild part. Buckle up, because this takes up a full like page and a half of our notes.
So just to preface this as well, you probably already know that I'm a true crime fan. But anyway, I've listened to this Chowchilla bus kidnapping a few different times, so I'm so excited that we actually have the connection that connects it to our podcast so that you can go over it, and I just can't wait to hear your
rendition. Yeah, I don't know, I've heard this one too multiple times before, and then it came up in this episode and I was like, what? Okay, so Carmen, this house, the Rangsdorf house, has a really random connection to the infamous Chowchilla bus kidnapping. For anyone that doesn't know, basically, oh gosh, this is just wild. So, first of all, this event made huge headlines around the world because it was, at the time, and I think still is, one of the largest abductions in U.S. history. So, on July 15th, 1976, three men hijacked a school bus with 26 children aboard in Chowchilla, California, which, if you don't know, is 114 miles from San Jose, and it's about halfway between Modesto and Fresno. Random, I've actually been there, like, years ago.
Chowchilla.
Yeah, it's like a farming town. It's random, but it was cool.
Do you know why you were there?
Yeah, I have family out there, actually, that I didn't know about. They're distant. Anyway, The bus, driven by Ed Ray, was on its usual route, dropping off students from Dairyland Elementary School, which, side fact, it still exists. And it looks interesting because it's small and unconventional for, like, a modern California high school. It looks really cute. Or not high school, but just a modern California school. It looks cute. It's across the street from an orchard, and it's located on Avenue 18 and a half, which is kind of cool. The three kidnappers then proceeded to drive the bus into a dry riverbed and hit the whole bus in a tree bush, where they then forced the children into two vans waiting nearby. They were actually forced to jump directly into the vans so that they wouldn't leave footprints. And then the vans had been made into makeshift jail cells. They had no windows or air ventilation, and they had wood paneling inside. They drove for almost 12 hours when they finally stopped at a rock quarry. And get this, they drove for almost 12 hours, but they only ended up 100 miles away from where they started, in Livermore.
What?
Yeah. There, the kidnappers took the children out of the van and forced them into an underground hole that they had made by burying an old truck trailer 12 feet underground.
Jesus Christ, where did they have the time for this?
Dude! it does not stop there. The hole was complete with makeshift toilets, containers of water, and basic food like bread and butter. Bread and peanut butter. So clearly it was all premeditated, you know.
Well, obviously, but still, like... Right. Think about the planning that went into this. Like, these two people were probably just like, what do you think? They got high, they were on drugs. What drugs do you think that they were on to even come up with this idea?
We can speculate about that. trust me, we're going to get to more details, and it's... Ooh. So, they installed two ventilation pipes as well to keep the air flowing in because, you know, it was an underground hole. After 12 hours, supplies were already running low, and the roof... of the trailer started to cave in.
Jeez, no.
Yeah. The group was basically saved, though, because the bus driver, Ed Ray, and then one of the students, who was, I guess, 14 at the time, Michael Marshall, actually took turns pushing up the manhole cover that blocked the opening to the hole using just, like, sheer force. They had no tools or anything.
Wow.
Yeah.
Those things are heavy.
Yeah. They had to dig their way up. Once they opened the manhole, they actually had to dig their way to the top. And after a total of 28 hours of being in the hole, they were free. And to the surprise of the quarry workers, they didn't know that they were there.
Just,
you know, popped out of the ground. And all these quarry workers are like, what? And so, yeah, as you can imagine, local police quickly arrived to the scene. And the victims were taken to Santa Rita Rehabilitation Center to be interviewed, fed, and examined by doctors. Again, this story was so groundbreaking at the time that media from all over the world covered the story. After 2 weeks, which I feel like seemed fast, I don't know, but after 2 weeks, the police were able to track down all three of the kidnappers. Their names were Frederick Newhall Woods, who was 24 at the time, James Schoenfeld, also 24, and then James's brother, Richard Schoenfeld.
What were you doing at 24 thinking about?
I started a podcast. What were you?
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about awful plots.
Literally. I mean, this was kind of an awful plot in a way.
Oh, yeah, I guess. I mean, at least it's a little bit more productive.
Just a little. Frederick's parents, get this, Carmen. Frederick's parents actually owned the rock quarry where he buried the victims.
I was like, watch, they're going to be related to this quarry.
Yes. And all three of them came from wealthy families that lived in, like, the nicest suburbs of San Francisco. Yeah. So they came from money.
Sir.
Also, you asked, when did they have time to do this? Security guards had actually seen all three of them digging the quarry months before the kidnapping. They had planned this for months.
Months. And they just feel so entitled that they can just get more money.
Yeah.
From the government.
Well, from anyone, whatever. It's wild. And we're getting to that. So when Frederick Woods' father's estate was searched, investigators found a handwritten note detailing the kidnapping plan, and the plan literally just said plan at the top. The plan and then the plan.
Not even the plan, just plan.
Mm-hmm. They found a draft of a ransom note and even a list of the kidnapped student's name, even a list of the kidnapped student's names written on the back of a jack-in-the-box wrapper.
Wait. So they had all the kids' names?
They took them down when they kidnapped them. Yeah, so they didn't, like, have that premeditated.
I'm just thinking if we ever make this into a modern-day movie, we should name it Plan.
Just Plan. So, let's see. All three of them were sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole. And there's very recent news on this. Richard Schoenfeld was granted parole in June 2012. His brother followed in 2015. Fred Woods was granted parole this past August.
Wow.
As in, like, 4 months ago.
Wait, okay. Also, how old are they now?
They're, like, in, I think... well, this happened in the 70s. They're in the 20s. They were in their 20s in the 70s, so... they're, like, in their 70s, 60s now.
Cue the...
I mean, yeah, okay. They're, like, in their 60s, 70s now. Yeah.
But, okay, think about it. How many months did it take for them to think about this plan, and how many months were they in jail?
It's not worth it.
We can't let them out. They've thought of too many other plans.
And they're just called Plan.
And that was just Plan. They didn't even... Plan A? Plan B?
So, again, you're probably wondering what all that has to do with the Rangstorff house. Long story short... Carmen, this is nuts. The three kidnappers did all of this because they planned to collect a $5 million ransom. And you know I love to figure out the inflation. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, in today's money. That's over $26 million. They wanted to collect that ransom because they ran into financial trouble trying to restore the Rangstorff house.
Dude, that's not worth it. They figured out how to restore it in 1991. That's only like, what? Less than 30 years.
Right. I'm like, bruh. And it's wild. Like, I think I mentioned this to you before, but this house essentially indirectly caused this entire situation.
Retro. Yeah. That's ridiculous. I honestly, again, not worth it. Not wild. Worth it.
All of that because of the Rangstorff house.
Okay. First of all, they got money from the government to restore the Rangstorff house, correct?
The kidnappers?
No, not the kidnappers. Just the Rangstorff friends in general.
Actually, I don't know where the funding came from, but I don't imagine it was from the government.
Are you sure, though?
Well, the city bought the house and then they restored it. So I think it was publicly funded, sorry.
So they would have gotten the money from the government anyway, or publicly funded anyway.
But it only happened once it was publicly bought.
Oh.
But the house was still privately owned.
Either way, not worth it.
I mean, the city bought it for a dollar, so. So as I mentioned, you know, this house has caused so much controversy politically and then in terms of crime, and it's just a hot mess. And, you know, Carmen, I haven't gone yet. I've been wanting to, but it still says that they're closed online. But I'd love to go sometime because it seems creepy. And also, again, after all that just happened, I need to know what this is about.
Maybe we have to get a little bit more insight and we have to watch Dirty Harry.
Oh, true. Yeah. I think that's it. Well, I guess that's it for this episode. We don't really know when we'll come out with another one again. But we missed doing this, and we're glad we're finally able to get another episode out there. In any case, we'll see you in the next one. And as always,
stay spooky, San Jose.